C1B, 1 and 2.
Number 4B.
So, perhaps in order to follow my explanation, going along the text of the textbook, it may be even easier for you, instead of going along with these epitomes on page 3 and 4, perhaps you only open up this matrix on page 6, and therefore you can see that going through the text, really, I follow now these columns vertically until the vertical column comes to an end, and I go to the second column, then to the third and fourth, and so on. Perhaps this is, at the beginning, the best way to do it, so that you just try to listen to this message. The way I'm going to show that this is not by reading the text anymore, as we did with the chapter on creation, because the text is too voluminous to do that. We would never get anywhere. Nor is it necessary. I read the text of the chapter on creation for the purpose of showing text interpretation, teaching the method and the rules of text interpretation. Whereas I take now this chapter as an example for something else, I take it now and go chronologically, diachronically through the chapter without reading it out to you, but using as much as possible the terms, the wordings of the textbook, so that those who know the textbook well find the similarity, they find themselves at home with the text. But I would say, don't try too much, if at all, to look into the textbook and see where I am, or your concentration is diverted. I think then perhaps you open it so that when I perhaps pinpoint to a marginal heading or something like that, that you know somehow where I am in the textbook. I will use as few terms of my own, but use the terms, the text that is in the textbook, so that you feel I'm honest to the text, that I don't put my personal interpretation into it. And perhaps later on, when you are much more interested in the subject, I think then if you take the textbook and perhaps the tapes, you will find then in the text my words and find that I'm going along with the text. Are we clear about the procedure? Because now I would say we will have perhaps about 5 or 6 hours that demand really good attention. But don't be afraid of it. I don't want to put the fear of the Lord into you by saying that. But do the following thing. Don't try to understand everything I say, because I'm going to spell out a lot of terms or half sentences or a third of sentences from the text and spell it out, because I have very good notes. I had to make very good notes and spell it out. But you must not understand what I spell out per se. But you only have to listen to this big law. Does it bring out in mind, in the subtone of mind, the contraposition? Does it really bring out, say, idea versus the statement of belief? Does it afterwards in spirit bring out really that it says this idea is the only real thing and the belief is not really real, and so on? So that the only purpose, the only thing you have to learn today and tomorrow, the whole day tomorrow, is nothing else but the conviction that there is a law in the subtones. Always the same law. Yes? Also, at the beginning, it may be more difficult because you have first to get used to that law. And as we go on, you can be quite sure that when we come to life and then to truth and to love, it just seems to become natural. Therefore, I spend all those hours, those many hours now, on this matrix, just for that one simple purpose, that you sit there and just watch the tonality and say, Yes, yes, it is so. First always, somehow, he says in mind, here it is idea, and the opposite is that belief. Uh-huh. Then you get to use that when it comes to spirit, he says, uh-huh, yes, that idea is actually the real thing, the true thing. You may not always use the term real or reality, but the tone of reality and of the thing that matters, and the other is not real. And then the third is always that you feel, ah, yeah, I can see that. That now she says that the one, the real one, is actually on top of the other one. It is supreme, it controls the lesser, it is not in the lesser. And then when you come to principle, can you already now remember what principle will say? Huh? A principle will say that the idea has a principle behind itself, that the idea can be traced back to its cause, can trace back to its fundamentals, and that that fundamental is God, whereas the belief cannot never trace back its authority to God. Yes? And then it comes the tone of life, and you know already now know what life will say. You know now that life will say, that idea, that is eternal, that is not fading, but the other thing is fading away. And then when we come to truth, you will already know, because it's so simple, that truth will show that that belief is an error, and that an error is an error, is a lie about the truth, and therefore that belief is just a lie, and therefore not really true, and therefore because it is not true, and just a lie about something, you come to love, which says, therefore, only the idea is something, the belief is actually not something, it's nothing. Yes? When you got that, what I just said, that's the only thing you will have to hear until tomorrow night. I don't ask very much indeed, huh? But just to let yourself so imbued with that law that it will stick to you like glue. That whatever then afterwards you are facing, say, in your life experience, some kind of an idea comes up, or some kind of a problem comes up, therefore a belief comes up, and you say, how am I going to deal with it now? Can I just say that if something comes up which says it is unlawful, just say, but the divine law destroys the belief in unlawfulness. You can say that, but it's a statement. You don't know why. You don't know why it does. You don't know what is involved in it. And therefore, afterwards, you can, when you know the law, you can go and say, all right, I contemplate now this proposition, say, of unlawfulness versus the law of God, and I contemplate it through the law of this Christ that dissolves the belief. Therefore, can you see that when we tackle the textbook in this way, that it is no more a reading book, but suddenly becomes a textbook. A reading book is that you can only read in it what is stated there. You can't read in a reading book that which is not stated therein. But in a textbook, you can read fundamental laws which are applicable for infinite application, which are not stated in the textbook. If in a book on physics you learn to know, say, the formula for gravitation, the gravitational law, and state it in its elements, then it's all what you learn in the textbook. And perhaps they give one or two examples. But that law, when you know that law, you can take and apply it to millions of different situations which are not stated in the textbook. That's the difference between a textbook and a reading book. Therefore, the student of Christian Science, when he has had a problem, he always went to the textbook to read in the textbook and read in the textbook to find an answer for his problem, how to solve the problem. No, that's not the way. That's not the way. That's devaluating the textbook to a reading book, devaluating the textbook to a recipe book. Where do I find the recipe for solving my problem? On which page? Usually you will not find a page, because experience is so big, is so varied. That means to say it doesn't take every one of those billions of experience and different experience and treats them in the book. She gives us the underlying laws. So, therefore, we have also to investigate the text of the textbook, not as stating us the solution for individual problems. We read the textbook and study the textbook for the purpose of finding fundamental laws which are infinitely applicable afterwards. Did I make that fundamental proposition very clear? Again, you see, we have a different approach to the textbook, quite different. We search in the textbook laws and not statements. We search in the textbook fundamental principles, which means fundamental laws, fundamental orders, fundamental rules, fundamental methods, fundamental system. And when we know that whole system, we know how to close the textbook and apply that system to any situation. This would be dealing with the textbook as a textbook. All right. So I begin to tell you what Mrs. Eddy shows first in the first subject of mind. Without really having to look now down to these nice epitomes and to the nice study material, you would already know now what the main point would be, that you would now show what that the idea of mind, the metaphysical idea, is doing what? It's dissolving the opposite, namely a material basis. Yes? If we know that, then we can say, how does that happen? And I ask now for the subtones. And you would now already feel, oh, I think I can already state what has to happen there, because mind would first have to state the problem, and first have to state that there is on one side really the idea of a metaphysical basis, and on the other side would be a material basis. Yes? And I tell you now in Mrs. Eddy's terms what she wrote there. So you just keep that tone of mind as mind awake, and don't let yourself now be sidetracked by what I read out of the text. Just only listen to it in the way that you weigh in your consciousness. Does it really say that? Is it really proved through the text? Well, what does she say? She speaks here in that paragraph about the idea of a metaphysical basis, that this idea of a metaphysical basis is really mind, and that mind is the cause of this metaphysical basis, whereas she can see on the other side that there is a challenge from an opposite belief, and she calls that in the side note materialistic challenge, namely the materialistic hypothesis that there is a material basis, and that therefore we have the challenge between materialism and idea. That's that. Very simple. Starts out now, what is this material world? Is it based on a material basis? Or is it based on a metaphysical basis? Quite simple. Quite simple, but very deep. You know, she deals always with very deep questions that regard the whole philosophy of the cosmos and of the world. All right. Having stated that, without having to look down really to our notes now, I don't know why I printed them so nicely and given them to you. I always say now, don't look down, because I want to wake up within you, you know, the possibility that you can now think creatively. The moment you have the grid, the system, that you can think out more or less by yourself now how the subject must evolve. So we come to the second subtone, spirit, wherein we have seen now when we have a metaphysical idea basis and a material sense as basis, we have to ask ourselves, which one of the two is now really real? Shall I go along with both? Are both good enough for me? Are both real for me? Are they two worlds going on? So I have to ask that question. And actually we would answer it and would say, from what we know about Christian Science, that you will have to say, you know, that material basis is not good at all. That's not good at all. It's evil. That cannot bring forth something good. But the metaphysical basis, that will be good. That will be real. That can bring forth something good. Wouldn't we say that? Yeah? All right. Mrs. Eddy says that too. Only that she says it with more words because, you see, she has other instruments playing into it. So what does she say? Her side note is confusion confounded. And something in her says, naturally, yes. Spirit always separates and there's no confusion. It makes it very clear. What does it make very clear? What she makes very clear is that those two cannot go together. He speaks about the half-metaphysical systems as that which tries to go together on both sides. Or we say, ride on both horses. I don't know if you have a wording like that. Where she says, look here, they are opposites. Their value is opposite. You can't mingle them. Keep them apart. Keep them apart. Don't try to mingle them into one, or you have a house divided against itself. It's pantheistic. You mix them up. Don't mix them up. Keep them apart, because only if you keep them apart, you arrive at true conclusions. What conclusions? She says, you see, Jesus did that. He sifted the chaff from the wheat. He put them aside. And he demonstrated that only the spiritual would unfold the reality of good and would unfold the unreality of evil. Yeah? See? We will go on to soul. What would soul have to say? Soul would have to say, now you have stated that they are apart and that Jesus put them apart, that he didn't like to mix them up all together. But they put them apart. For what purpose? Because one unfolds good and the reality of good, and the other unfolds the unreality, the nothingness of evil. So what are you going to do now with those two? Soul comes along and says, well, then you have to see that the one is superior to the other. That metaphysics is above physics and therefore exchanges the object of sense for the ideas of soul. You get now the sense that divine metaphysics is above physics. It says metaphysics is above physics. Can you hear soul now? Superior. And when it is superior, and metaphysics is superior to the objective world, to the material basis, then divine metaphysics resolves things into thought, exchanges the object of sense for the ideas of soul. Then alone ideas are tangible and real, are tangible for spiritual consciousness. They alone have identity. Yes? So you have the point of soul. You have made up your mind that you take the stand of metaphysics, that metaphysics is above physics, that from the metaphysical point of view, you begin to control physics, and by controlling physics, you exchange the objects of sense through the ideas of soul, and that is actually spiritually tangible, that ideas are spiritually tangible. Then we go to principle. What should principle say? Principle will have to say that only the metaphysical idea has a principle behind it, that matter has no principle behind it, is not grounded on a principle. Wouldn't we say that? But therefore we have not a material principle to work on. So Mrs. Eddy shows that too in a bit greater, in a large way. She begins about the biblical foundations, real principle, foundations, and shows the true foundations, that metaphysics is a true foundations, that Jesus was building on those true foundations, that the apostles, the prophets, were building on that true foundations, namely on the science of mind, that mind has a science, has a principle behind it, the science of mind. Other foundations, there are none. Can you see? There are no other foundations. Therefore, she says, I reject the theories of matter, that matter has a principle. I reject the theories, that's a marginal heading, namely that all is matter, or that matter is as real as mind. I reject that. I tell you the right theory. Theory is always the principle behind something. I give you the right theory, namely that there is only one mind, only one mind, one intelligence governing the universe, and only in this way can we find logical conclusions. Whereas under the side mark of prophetic ignorance, she shows that the prophets did not yet know that principle, the signs of it, that they were looking out really for, looked for something higher than the systems of their time, because they didn't have a principle behind it. And so they did not know yet anything precise about the teaching and demonstration of that one mind, you see, and could not see yet God's more infinite meaning that would enable them to demonstrate the science of mind. Yeah? Is that clear? Okay, here we break it up, and tonight at 7 o'clock.